Going to read this morning from Canto 3, Chapter 23, text number 8. Title of the chapter is Devahuti's Lamentation. Of course, this part of it is Devahuti's Jubilation. Because this is text 8, the background, what precedes this 8 is 22 is her marriage, the scene of her one sense arranged marriage, but she selected her husband and Swayambhuva Manu requested Kardamuni to accept his daughter. He gave reasons. Kardamuni accepted, gave his reasons, and the marriage took place right there in the forest by his hermitage, and gifts of dowry and so forth, and this a forest wedding ceremony more or less is described. And the king went back feeling separation from his daughter. Certainly the daughter felt separation from him too. They had deep affection for one another. He returned to his palace and performed the duties of a great soul, a religious person, great devotee, and the ruler. So that's described. And then this chapter opens with now they're married and living in the forest, and although she's of a royal order daughter, princess, accustomed to opulent, most opulent palace life, she, by her own choosing, is now serving someone who's living in the forest with only what the forest supplies, naturally. So her clothing habits and eating habits and cosmetic habits and all the other things that lavish life provides was gone, and she adopted the simplicity of her husband. And over a period of thousands of years, she very happily and very dutifully served her husband. She became lean and thin, emaciated, it's described. Her hair became matted, and so forth. So, seeing the condition of his good wife, Kardamuni, who was a great devotee and a mystic, and having associated so closely with his wife, understood the desire of his wife, which was naturally that she wished to have a child. So he spoke with her. In the following manner. Starting with text 6. O respectful daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. So invoking her lofty family line. Today I am very much pleased with you for your great devotion and most excellent loving service. Since the body is so dear to embodied beings, I am astonished that you have neglected your own body to use it on my behalf. I have achieved the blessings of the Lord. He's disclosing something to her apparently that they hadn't talked about. This thing happens in relationships. So something that she didn't know was that Lord Vishnu, through the time spent before their marriage, he was living in the forest, practicing the process of meditation with such intensity, fixing his mind upon Lord Vishnu, that Lord Vishnu descended from the spiritual realm and came before him, right there in the forest. And they had a conversation. And he bestowed upon Kardamuni his blessings. So now he's going to say to her that the nature of those blessings, what does it mean to receive blessings from the personality of Godhead? An ordinary person can't understand. An ordinary person can't see. And I'm going to show to you so you'll see. And then you'll understand what it is that I received, the blessings of Lord Vishnu. So he says it this way. I've achieved the blessings of the Lord in my discharge, in discharging my own religious life of austerity, meditation, and Krishna consciousness. Now those three different things. There's power that comes from austerity. Even Hrishikashipu became powerful through his austerity. Vrikasura became... When we observe, you know, austerities, like fasting on Ekadasi days or whatever, you know, we do, that may be an austerity. That's the body. For some religious purpose, the distinction I'm going to be making here is religious purpose and transcendental purpose. Same activity can have religious purpose and or can have religious, a transcendental purpose. So, just the religious activity of austerity for, you know, religiously prescribed activities that are austere, there's merit that goes to that person. Power and strength and something. So that's the body and then the mind, meditation. So control the senses and control the mind. And then Krishna consciousness. So all three, he was not only knew that there are three different divisions, not only he was accomplished, he was superlative. I have achieved the blessings of the Lord in discharging my own religious life of austerity, meditation, and Krishna consciousness. Although you have not yet experienced these achievements, which could mean either what he had achieved or she had not yet achieved them herself, which are free from fear and lamentation, you know, the dualities of material existence. One has taken transcendentalists, in any case, not just religious people, but transcendentalists are taken beyond hankering and lamenting. Or, in other words, the achievements were of the soul. They're not something that you can lose. So, something material is something you can lose. You get some money and you lose some money. You get some strength and you lose some strength. You get some ability to draw nice paintings. And then you can lose that ability to draw nice paintings. Something that you can gain and lose, hankering and lamenting. So beyond duality, something that's an asset of the soul. It's not born of anything material. It cannot be interrupted by anything material. Although you have not yet experienced these achievements, which are free from fear and lamentation, I shall offer them to you, all of them to you, because you are engaged in my service. Now just look at them. I'm giving you the transcendental vision to see how nice they are. So we have this verse in Bhagavad Gita, tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadikshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshana. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. It's not like there's an on-off switch and the self-realized soul says, okay, you're good, so turn the switch on. Now you can see. Oh, you're bad, now turn the switch off, you can't see. It's not like that. Kardamuni is going to arrange by his mystic power a quite different residential place for Devahuti than living in the forest, and that's part of what she'll be able to see. That is something that he did consciously, willfully manifest. It was a flying city, not just like a house, a flying city with avenues and parks and everything. Huge. Huge palace with assistant attendants and everything. So all paraphernalia of a royal palace, mystically manifest. So he was, in addition to being a pious Brahmin, religious pious Brahmin, and a unalloyed devotee, he was a mystic. Kardamuni was very, very special. So because he had that qualification, he was able to give that which he had. And the emphasis that Prabhupada is making in his purport is receiving the mercy of Krishna by rendering service to the devotee of Krishna. Because whatever it is, whether it's a mystic or a pious man or a devotee person, whatever it is that one has, including devotion or including wealth or mysticism, it's from the personality of Godhead. So the treasure, or the treasury of an unalloyed devotee is Krishna's property, and that person can distribute Krishna's property, Krishna's mercy. Bhagavat prasada. Yasya prasada, bhagavat prasada. There's two paragraphs where he's discussing this. So this is just to appreciate the background for the text 8. Kardamuni is not ungrateful. He's most grateful. He was living independently without his wife. He wasn't like unhappy and grumpy or something. But he is especially appreciating the devotion of his wife and how she's using her everything, with the gifts that God had given to her, to serve her good husband. He recognized that and was appreciating that. Then this morning's verse, Kardamuni continued, what is the use of enjoyments other than the Lord's grace? All material achievements are subject to be annihilated simply by the movement of the eyebrows of Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By your principles of devotion to your husband, you have achieved and can enjoy transcendental gifts very rarely obtained by persons proud of aristocracy and material possessions. Again, there's this. The message is, transcendental gifts are not subject to coming into being and going out of being, nor are they this is important, nor are they necessarily achieved. Transcendental gifts are not necessarily achieved by hankering for the transcendental gifts, but rather through service. And through service, through the medium of service, the mercy of Krishna comes, one is bestowed or decorated with transcendental gifts that aren't subject to time, that aren't subject to circumstance. You know, the real contentment and happiness of the soul that's so transcendental or beyond the purview of time and circumstance, that one is always happy. It's not just like, oh, I've got gifts, now I'm happy. It's the connection with the Supreme Lord. That's the greatest gift. Restore that connection. So by serving her husband, she had restored that connection with the Supreme Lord. And the consequence is going to be, as was foretold already, that the Lord would appear as their son. So how elevated was the qualification of Kardamuni and Devahuti, the son, the personality of God, it became their son. He's making a contrast, saying that all material achievements are perishable. And they're so perishable than just the twinkle of the eye of the Supreme Lord in Devan. It doesn't even take a twinkle, it's just his time energy destroys everything. It's like a kaleidoscope. You ever look through a kaleidoscope? You know what it is? It's like a tube, shaped like a tube. Like commonly it's cardboard or something like that, tube. And inside there's two things, a set of mirrors and some little pieces like objects. It's, you know, geometric shapes. And you look through the lens and you see it's just one, like one object, because it's through mirrors, you see it symmetrically presented. You have this one, this one, this one, this one, this one. And then you turn the kaleidoscope and it stays in that position, suddenly there's a whole change of how everything looks. Now those pieces are in a different position. And that's a different symmetrical this and this and this and this and this. And you turn it some more and it's fine. And then the objects change their position. They reflect on the mirrors in a different way. And then it looks different. And then different and different. Just, it's different all the time. Now in that case, it's you dependent upon your hand moving the cylinder, the kaleidoscope. If you just keep your hand still, then it doesn't change. So what's being said here is this material existence is like a kaleidoscope, only the time energy keeps is the hand that keeps turning things. So you can't keep it like this. Your body is what it is right now, and oh, I like my body the way it is right now. I'm fine, I don't have to change. We don't have that option. It keeps changing. And the picture keeps changing and changing and changing and ever changing. So anything that exists at this moment, trust, it's going to change. Whatever it is that we have at this moment, trust, it's going to change. It can be more, it can be less, it can be different. But it's going to change and change. So if one becomes attached to the configuration of the material energy today, that person is fool number one, because it's going to change and change and change. And you don't know what the next change is going to be. But for sure, the one that you had previously is going to be gone. So Kardamuni is saying to his good wife, fortunate for you, you've grown indifferent to the configuration of matter. Before you were a princess, now you're an emaciated wife of a Brahmin in the forest. But that's going to change too. The picture is going to change. But so what's important for a transcendentalist is the orientation of the soul towards the Supreme Soul. Not even that the Supreme Soul is going to give me this and give me that. This configuration instead of another configuration, one I don't like so much. This it's the connection with the Supreme Soul. That's unchanging. Circumstances are still going to change even for a devotee of the Lord. But whatever the circumstances, whatever the configuration of matter that Krishna arranges, that's the frame in which we're to serve, whatever that is, and find happiness in the service, not, I don't like this configuration, I want another one. Then he speaks of a religious principle and a transcendental principle. The religious principle in her case was the religious duty of a wife to serve her husband. Because if you're religiously observing that religious principle so carefully, you'll achieve a nice configuration of the kaleidoscope. But because your husband is one who has received transcendental gifts from the Supreme Lord, that is naturally then going to go to you. Not just the pious ones, of being a pious wife who is faithful to her husband, but you'll hear Prabhupada saying the purport, when the wife is very fortunate and her husband is also spiritually very qualified, the spiritual qualifications of the husband become the spiritual qualifications of the good wife. It's just Krishna's this system. So, you know, somebody might say, well, why did he do it like that? Why isn't it more equal or something? Why do women have to serve their husbands? Why the husbands don't spend 50% of their time serving their wives? He is a qualified husband, is by receiving, by performing the duties of his life in the proper way, mercy of the Supreme Lord is then coming into his life, and that merit is shared with the wife. Now, it can work the other way too. If a wife becomes very qualified, husband certainly benefits from that qualification of the wife, just by their association together as they do, husband and wife. But emphasis here specifically is upon in the case of Kardamuni and Devahuti, Kardamuni's superlative qualification and what Devahuti receives because of his qualification, or in a general sense, in a husband-wife relationship, the merit of the husband goes to the wife. So it's beneficial for the husband to achieve spiritual well-being, because the members of the family automatically receive that benefit. Here he's consciously transferring his benefit, all of his benefit to her, all of his benefit to her. And then he concludes by saying, this benefit is rarely achieved simply by past piety. By past piety one can achieve our aristocratic birth and material possessions. And it's very rare for persons who have those things to achieve the transcendental things, mainly because they're too attached to the temporary things. Oh, this is nice configuration of material energy. I like it. And become attached, not knowing the kaleidoscope is going to turn and turn and turn. It'll all be gone. But because it's nice, they want to stay. They want things to stay, and they're attached to that. And in that mood of attachment, there's tendency, strong tendency, to neglect the spiritual attainment or the non-material asset, the connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead in pure devotion. So for those of us that aren't yet pure devotees, there's enormous benefit in serving those who are. So in minimally, with the ISKCON context, is we have our founder Acharya, and whatever situation one may be in, meaning whether his initiated disciple or receiving his instructions through his writings and literatures and so forth, great benefit can come into our lives, even when we're not so having an exalted birth or great opulence of piety, wealth of piety. Kali Yuga is not like that in general. Like Prahlad Maharaj, he speaks about his disqualification of not having, or having been born in a family of Hiranyakashipu, imagine. Not just having a bad father, super demon father. Phew. So he's feeling very disqualified. And Rupa Goswami's Asha Bandha, the prayer of great hope. Asha means a desire or aspiration. It's in Nectar Devotion, chapter 18, very nice prayer, where he's reciting his disqualifications. I'm not well educated. I have no devotion. I'm not even born in a good family. I'm filled with disqualifications. And so I don't have the merit to approach you, Gopichala Balaba, but I'm shamelessly doing so anyway because you're my hope. I'm hopeless, but you're most merciful. And those who approach you with feeling and sincerity, you're very kind. And that's my hope. Hope against hope, that you'll kindly bestow upon me your devotional service. Please extend your two lotus feet so I can serve them in this mood of humility. So exalted devotees are qualified, but they, in their humility, they feel not qualified, and that's part of their qualification. And in this situation, it's the Devahuti serving her husband. And he's extending his mercy to her in an explicit form, appreciating very rare someone born in an aristocratic family like you has left behind their aristocratic ways and the pride that goes with those aristocratic ways. Oh, just see how much I have. And my position of the daughter of the Lord of the whole planet, Swayambhuva Manu, the emperor of all mankind. I'm the daughter. So you've left that behind, and all the material things that go with opulent legal life. You've done that simply to serve me, and I'm not an ungrateful person. I recognize this, and I want to reciprocate. So let me read what Prabhupada presents, just two paragraphs. Lord Chaitanya recommended that the greatest achievement of human life is to achieve the grace of the Lord. Love of God. He said, Prema Pumartho Mahan. To achieve love of Godhead is the highest perfection of life. The same perfection is recommended by Kardama Muni to his wife. Although he hasn't specifically used love of God as what he's about to bestow or assist his wife in achieving. That's what is being spoken of. Generally, those who are very materialistic and who possess material wealth and prosperity are unable to appreciate the value of transcendental love of God. Although Devahuti was a princess coming from a very great royal family, fortunately she was under the supervision of her great husband, Kardama Muni, who offered her the best gift, love of God, which is bestowed in human life, the grace of the Lord or love of God. This grace of the Lord was achieved by Devahuti by the goodwill and satisfaction of her husband. She served her husband, who was a great devotee and saintly person, with sincerity, love, affection, and service, and Kardama Muni was satisfied. He willingly gave love of God, and he recommended that she accept it and enjoy it, because he had already achieved it. Now this is specific to husband-wife relation, and you can extract a principle from this particular application. It's supposing, it's not husband-wife, supposing it's somebody else or another type of relationship where someone is very elevated personality, and the same principles apply. There's different application points, let's read the second paragraph. There's the material side of the duty of a wife to her husband, and then there's the transcendental side of the qualification of the husband and how the wife benefits. So you put the two together and you get what Devahuti got. Paragraph. Love of God is not an ordinary commodity. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was worshipped by Rupa Goswami because he, Lord Chaitanya, distributed love of God, Krishna Prema, to everyone. Rupa Goswami praised him as Mahavadanya, a greatly munificent person, because he was freely distributing to everyone love of Godhead, which is achieved by wise men only after many, many births. Krishna Prema, Krishna consciousness, is the highest gift which can be bestowed on anyone whom we presume to love. Now with the love of Godhead, there's some, like in the Bhagavad Gita, requirement is surrender, abandon all other varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. Make that your mama come. Just do that one thing. So that seems like a condition. You have, abandon other things and take this one thing. Lord Chaitanya didn't require first surrender to me and then. He just gave and gave and gave and gave and gave and gave. Now something that comes so freely, we may take for granted. There's no obligation. I just take it. So something that comes freely might be like that. But there is something in that, in the act of willingly receiving the gift that Lord Chaitanya wants to give, there's submission. It must be. Because otherwise we've got our hands full of material things. And to receive this thing he wants to give, we have to recognize the distinction between the material things that our hands are filled with and the gift that Lord Chaitanya is wishing to give us, and let go of one and take the other, at least progressively. And that highest gift is love of God. Attraction for eternal loving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead exclusively. Nothing of selfish interest, just loving service. The greatest of gifts. One word used in this verse, Nija Dharma Dohan, is very significant. Devahuti, as the wife of Kardamuni, achieved an invaluable gift from her husband because she was very faithful to him. And this is the last sentence. It's the religious part and the transcendental part. For a woman, the first principle of religion is to be faithful to her husband. If, fortunately, the husband is a great personality, which isn't always the case, then the combination is perfect, and the lives of both the wife and the husband are at once fulfilled. So supposing the husband isn't a great personality, does that discount the former one? Well, he's not such a great personality. Look, I live with the person. I know how great that person is. So I don't have to do the religious part. And we were having a discussion the other day, different context, but it was an ISKCON context. There's persons who are in the position of leadership and management, and those persons may not be, let's assume they're not Uttama Adhikari devotees. So, if they were Uttama Adhikari devotees, then it's certainly I would do what they would say. And carry out duties nicely. And if they're not, I'm going to pick and choose the things that I'll carry out because, supposing they made some discrimination error and it's not, instead of doing this, it should have been that. So I don't want to follow a person that doesn't know that, the right thing to do. I want to be independently thoughtful and pick and choose. And then you get, a bunch of people that are picking and choosing and picking and choosing based on their sensibilities of what is the right thing and, with refined discrimination because I'm a detached Brahmin. I don't do any administration and management. And what's the picture look like? It's not what. So we were having this discussion with a couple of devotees, and so now what to do when the husband may not be, or the leader and manager may not be the Uttamadhikari. I'm the wife, or I'm the member of the organization, the society of Vaishnavas, in which the leader is not an Uttamadhikari. And I'm studying Prabhupada's books, and I understand some things, and I'm not so sure when the husband says go left, we should go left. Or not sure when the leader says we should go right, we should go right. And then you got a whole bus full of people saying which direction to go. The system that Prabhupada gave us is he invested authority in individuals that were, by his own acknowledgement, were not Uttamadhikaris. They weren't perfected beings. On the other hand, Prabhupada acknowledged the intent of faithful followers and honored that, and then gave them service and gave them authority and responsibility that connect with that authority. Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj shared this with me. There was a room conversation where Prabhupada was speaking about the importance of associating with a pure devotee, and so in the assembly, one devotee asked, "Srila Prabhupada, on the planet today, how many pure devotees are there?" The Prabhupada turned to his secretary and said, "How many initiated disciples are there now?" He said, 300. "There are 300 pure devotees on the planet today." Pretty liberal. Honoring, let's say, the intent, or the means to come to that stage is careful following of standards and everything, submission to because submission to persons who are invested with some authority means submission to the person who is investing them with authority. And ultimately it's, submission to Krishna. If that's the consciousness, the consciousness of submitting oneself to Krishna, even there may be imperfection, that's the Krishna conscious part that's being spoken of here in this verse. Now in this case, Kardamuni, he was that person. He was an Uttama Adhikari. And he was carrying Krishna in his heart, or Lord Vishnu in his heart, consciously. He wasn't always exhibiting that status. It was more internal. But because he had that gift, he was able to give that gift. We can give gifts of what we have, not what we don't have. So for each of us, as Vaishnavas, we're in one way or another way, besides we're serving as Vaishnavas, we're also leading. What Prabhupada wanted for ISKCON, his followers, to be first class men and women, meaning, qualified Brahmana Vaishnavas. And those who are so qualified are leaders, just by the way that you live your life. You're setting a standard or an example that others can look to and see. And if there isn't the Vaishnavas that set that standard, who are people going to look to and see? It's a service. Even others may not know you're a Vaishnava. You know, and Krishna knows, and this is a means that Krishna provides for benefiting the whole society, the whole world. When we engage in devotional service, where is this? One of the prayers of Prahlad, and I'm not recalling the words right now, but he was, the indication is that one who is engaged in devotional service is doing the best welfare work for all living entities in the universe. And we can't even think of all living entities in the universe. But service can be done simply by becoming pure in your chanting of the holy name and letting your behavior, your achar, reflect the life of pure devotion. So by making the heart, what's inside, making that pure, it'll come out wherever you go, in the house and out of the house and in the marketplace and in the workplace and in the social community and wherever. So the consciousness of pure devotion is of the greatest benefit for all living entities. That's a big statement, especially, again, we can't even think of all living entities. But that benefit can be achieved. Yeah, the context of that was, trying to recall just now. Anyway. Yeah. The context in the Bhagavatam is the earlier in this canto where Vidura meets Maitreya, chapter 5 of this canto. Vidura meets Maitreya and he presents his appreciation of Maitreya's qualification. And then says, basically, Krishna Katha, please. And any other conversation, any other sound vibration makes the mind bewildered and so forth. So just Krishna Katha. And then he specifically says, I'd like to hear about the Purusha avatar forms of the Lord and their activities of creation. This is one of the glories of the personality of God. There's the big pie, and that's, just give me one of that little slice over there, the one that's the Purusha avatar slice. Please describe the Supreme Lord who's kind to all living beings and how he engages his energies in the process of creation and maintenance of the whole cosmic manifestation, please. And then Maitreya says, questions like this are beneficial both for the speaker and the hearer and for all living entities. One can render the best of service to all living entities just by discussing these topics. We're just sitting in a room and suburbs of Detroit. How's this? All living entities are being benefited. To whatever extent we can benefit any other living entity by pleasing the Supreme Lord and purifying our consciousness by this activity. It's right in the Bhagavatam stated by Maitreya to Vidura. It's service to all living entities, not just even human forms of life. Because the consciousness of human existence impacts all other forms of life, knowingly or unknowingly. Look at this like place that's coming up here. Remember coming sometime, it's just like there was some, and then spaces, and now it's like a child's mouth, and all the teeth are starting to come in. And you know, before we got here, there was all these other living entities here. There were trees, and there was insects, and there were birds, and there were, and you know, now there's, where'd they go? They got displaced. They had to go somewhere else. So how we, without all the details, how we conduct our lives impacts all other forms of life. How we live in harmony with or in confrontation with nature and the laws of nature and the living entities that are dependent, just like the Prachetas, when they came out of the sea and they saw that for 10,000 years there's been no cultivation of the land and everything has grown up in wild forest and vegetation, they started clearing land. But they did in such a way they would have destroyed everything. So Soma, the moon god, came and said, hey, stop. Because the trees and the creepers and this is food, not just for the human society, but for all other insects and birds and beasts, and you know, they have a right to live too, and the vegetation, they have a right to live too, and you're the protectors of mankind as the sons of King Prachinibari, so protect them too. I mean, so the consciousness of the human form has an impact on all the other forms of life. We have the power to protect, and we have the power to destroy. We have developed consciousness, and with that developed consciousness, we can make a good impact, we can make the most horrible impact, depending upon consciousness. How it's utilized, the facilities of human existence. So developing your Krishna consciousness is the best way to serve all living entities. That's the statement of the Bhagavatam through the mouth of Kardamuni. And it's not like we have to, you know, like a top, spin faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. You know what a top is, right? Faster and faster. And then we can serve all living entities, just like move fast. It's not a question of your external activity as much as it is your Krishna consciousness. And then what to speak of collectively, the Krishna consciousness and Krishna consciousness and Krishna consciousness of the devotees of the Lord collectively has a really wonderful impact, more than any one of us can do alone. It's like, take coals and move the coals closer and closer and closer until they're one little pile. You get fire, not just heat. So through association, if we can somehow get beyond our own contaminations and associate properly with one another, wonderful things can be done beyond anything that any one of us can do on our own. This is certainly a most important principle of Krishna consciousness, association with devotees, and through the association of devotees, cooperating together to serve Krishna in Krishna's interest. And there's always going to be diversity. That's nice too. And having some unity, that's nice too. Unity in diversity. At least the unity in principle that we're giving our energy to the service of Krishna as best we can. Not like everybody. Anyway, diversity is honored. Unity is there in. Unity doesn't necessarily mean conformity. It means the service of Krishna is the top priority. Okay, so that's the discussion for this morning. Any comments or questions? Okay.
Achieving that status, why Krishna has to offer like what they asked prayer? Like they went for something, but they convinced with something else. They went for some material desire, but they got the love of Godhead itself. But after giving the love of Godhead, why he has to fulfill the desire? Like what when they have no taste for it?
Well, can I just modify the language a little bit? Because he doesn't have to do anything. So I think what you mean is, although they have no longer some a taste or attraction, why is it that that former taste or attraction or hankering is then fulfilled?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not always, first of all, it's not always that that's the case. And the criterion that Krishna made, who can say what that criterion is when he does and what he doesn't. Certainly, an option is some purpose to be fulfilled. Through the devotee having that situation and some purpose, his purpose. Or Krishna recognizing residual tendency. Like Dhruva, he eventually went back to Godhead, but before he went back to Godhead, he ruled for 60,000 years, and during the time he ruled for 60,000 years, he again exhibited not transcendental anger. When his brother, stepbrother was killed, and he went to take revenge, and he got carried away with anger. So, maybe there's a number of options, a number of lists from the menu of why the Supreme Lord might do what he does. To help, completely purify where there's residual tendency. Worldly attachment.
Yeah. So after that, how long do you bringing back her to
her opulent life? Yeah. Well, in this case, it's, several things. She was to have a personality of Godhead as her son. So that was a transcendental reason why her prior wish was fulfilled. And another is, at least by her own statement, she had attachment. She had attachment for anticipating family. She had attachment for family once the family was there. Now one could say the other way around, as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, when she says, after Karamuni left to go back to the forest, I think I was here when we discussed this. Why did he leave to go back to the forest? Because to meditate on the personality of Godhead, when the personality of Godhead was right in his home as his son. He didn't need to go anywhere to meditate on him. Anyway, But he did. And then she was alone, at least without her husband, who she had been with for thousands of years, serving faithfully and so naturally attached. Now he's gone. So she speaks, Devahuti speaks to Kapila Dev, saying, I'm attached. Help. And in the commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Kapila Dev was smiling, indicates he was thinking, what are you talking about, attached? You're my mother, and I'm the personality of Godhead. You're attached to me. That's not you have no material attachments. I'm not material. You're attached to me. And so you're just speaking that way for the benefit of others. So I'll oblige you. So this is an example of, there's an indication of the Supreme Lord, there's a purpose of the Supreme Lord to be fulfilled, and therefore a exalted devotee or a pure devotee may be given some material situation which they can then use for a transcendental purpose as an instrument of the Supreme Lord. So there's a variety of why the Lord might do what he does. And to understand his purpose is beyond ordinary living beings. Ask Bhishma Dev. You had something?
So this in the purpose, and you know, Krishna praying, love of God is the best.
Yes.
We can achieve. And
yeah.
Over the last several days, I've been hearing about how it requires greed or intense desire and humility, but this greed for this.
I got it.
How do we develop greed? How do we fan this greed so that it develops?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. And associating with those that have that qualification. And we can associate not just by, you know, physical proximity, we can associate this way. Sound vibration. And by association, it's explicit in Rupa Goswami's teaching that to hanker for, what to speak of, have greed for the love of the residents of Vrindavan that they had for Krishna requires association with the resident of Vrindavan. You had something? Yes. You go, Kishore.
Maharaj, temporary means it is there, it is temporarily there, then after some time it's not there. Illusory means it appears it is there, but it's not. My question is, this universal form is illusion. But in Bhagavad Gita, only chapter it's spoken,
Your question specifically is, why is so much time spent on it? Or what? Clarify your question. It's a very difficult subject to understand, I must admit. So if you want to say, why is it a difficult subject matter to understand, that's another question.
No, actually my question is, the river subjects, the tree subjects, the universal form, and the descriptions are like that, as though it is real. But it is explained in English. So, I'm going through this, okay, it's real, real, real. if one line is put, we have no power. But again, it is mentioned here, isn't it? As well, for example, Ecuador.
Well, you should. You've been around for a while, so you know how things are sometimes described this way, and things are sometimes described that way, especially subtle and nuanced subjects are sometimes described in different ways. So you must have learned the art of being not confused by those different descriptions that come from time to time this way or that way. So don't allow your mind to be bewildered by different descriptions. Just continue to hear, and through hearing and hearing and hearing, the objective is to understand the subject. The subject is, what is this Virat Rup? What is it? And it's mysterious. That's, for starters, it's mysterious. It's not easily understood. Yeah, it's specifically for those that approach it from the platform of mental speculation. Then it appears to be like this, and then it appears to be like that, and, well, wait a minute, what happened to this? Now it's that, and that becomes, maybe it's this again, or maybe it's yet a third thing, and it's not going to be understood by mental speculation. That's how it's going to be understood. It's a fact, confirming what you said, in a number of places. It's spoken of again and again. And it's difficult each time it's spoken about. And then it's spoken of again. It even sounds like, it's a little different than the way it was spoken about before. And my head is spinning. Well, we can go on to another chapter. So, but by staying with the subject matter, it's spoken of again and again because it's important. So it's important in a different way than, what's the economy of Detroit today? That's a fascinating subject. There's volumes written on, and that's illusion. It's not universal form. It's not the subject matter that we're interested in. It's an aspect of it. Whatever. But the bigger picture of the universal form is, it's a real form. You can say, probably, and, not but, it's a real form, and it's temporary. But the Lord's form isn't temporary. But this is one of the Lord's forms that's temporary. Well, that sounds like a contradiction. The Lord's form is eternal, not temporary, and here's one of the Lord's forms that's temporary. So in that sense, we can say it's an illusory form. At the same time, on the other hand, it's one of the Lord's forms. It's not like, what's the economy of Detroit today? It's one of the Lord's forms. And the way that universal form is described. I mean, look at the way in chapter 11 the universal form is described, and look at the way that the Virat Rup is described in the first chapter of Canto 2, and the way that the two are described appear to be different. One is all these hosts of celestial beings, and over here this other one is, the hills and the clouds and the sky and the sun and the moon, and it's like pantheism. God is in nature. They're both Virat Rup. It's just different ways of viewing the Virat Rup. I remember years ago, very, very clearly, I remember it was a good question. Somebody asked, it was Satsrup Maharaj, they asked Satsrup Maharaj, is this the same Virat Rup in the two depictions, Canto 2, Chapter 1, and Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 11? And could you describe the how they're the same or how they're different? And you know, the other response, he just recited, here's what Krishna says in Chapter 11, and here's what Shukadeva Goswami describes in Chapter 1. He didn't try to go beyond that and say this is the connection between the two. It's the universal form. Similarly, what Mother Yashoda saw within the mouth of Krishna when she looked to see if he had dirt, she saw the universal form. As Arjuna saw the universal form. It's the universal form in that case was all around, and in this case it was within the body of Krishna. And please remember that Markandeya Rishi saw that also. When Krishna, who was lying on his back on a banyan leaf, inhaled, Karamuni went inside the body of that little child, and there he saw the universal form. Different, you know, angle of vision than Mother Yashoda, who was looking inside his mouth. He was inside the body. And then he exhaled, and there he was floating in the causal ocean, or the ocean of devastation. But what was it that he wanted? It was a response to Narayan Rishi, I'd like to see your illusory energy. And it's the universal form. But it's not the illusory energy in the same way that we normally think of the illusory energy. It's a different way of perceiving the illusory energy. It's this temporary form, this form of the universe. And the whole universe, it's this illusory energy. And the totality of it is the universal form, which is his energy. It's his form. But it's illusory. It's a subtle subject that by empirical, you know, examining kind of approach, it won't be understood. It can be contemplated, but it won't be understood. If one uses that approach, in the final analysis, they'll come to an impersonal conclusion. It's a representation of something. The Brahman that's behind, and this is illusory, and reality is Brahman. That's where it goes. Something else? Mataji?
I just wanted to pursue this topic about serving a spouse who's spiritually, let's say, I think most of us are pretty disqualified, but maybe less qualified. And
amongst the disqualified, the lower regions
well,
of qualified.
Relative, I think, as we're looking around, it's all relative.
But that's what you're asking. I want to clarify.
What I'm asking is sort of taking this a step further where, you know, and it can go either way, but if one is trying to serve a spouse
got it.
Who is less spiritually inclined
got
than
it.
Oneself.
Okay.
And in trying to serve the spouse, it's actually taking you away because the spouse is
wants to do things.
Is more into the worldly stuff,
okay.
Which is actually a deterrent to one's spiritual advancement. And so, how do you? I mean, I know you did talk about trying to be. You want to be first-class citizens, and you want your conduct to inspire maybe the other spouse.
Yes.
But
and please, Krishna.
Anything a little more. Specific when it's actually
sure.
taking you away.
Sure.
What
It's difficult. It's difficult. That's, you know, that's the more. There's internal and there's external cultivation of Krishna consciousness. And the most important for one who is serving a spouse who is less spiritually advanced is the internal cultivation. Without the internal cultivation, the train isn't coming out of the station. It's going to stay, you know, it's not going to go anywhere. So focus first on the internal, you know, one's own qualification as opposed to the qualification of the spouse. That's part of Krishna consciousness. And then, I've seen it again and again. There's exceptions. I've seen that too. But when that Krishna conscious internal position is taken, commonly, not always, there's movement from the other side. Slow. But, you know, the service is the service to Krishna. This is an important element in the spouse who is less spiritually advanced. The service is to Krishna. By that I mean, my dear Lord Krishna, you have, just as you've given me this body and this mind and, you know, whatever ability I have and intelligence I have and whatever it is, it's something you've given me. And this is also something that you've given me. It's your arrangement for me. Here's a spirit soul. It's your part and parcel. And I'm rendering service to you by serving your part and parcel. So in other words, the service is unto Krishna. There's the other soul, but the service is unto Krishna. Not that the soul is incidental, but in one sense incidental, in this sense, in your previous life it wasn't this particular soul, and in your next life it's not that particular soul. It's life-specific, and even for some part of your life, it's not like in the earlier part of your life it was this soul, it's in who knows what's going to happen later on. But, you know, this is a service that you've entrusted to me. I am serving you. So, not forgetting that, keeping that, not even like putting it in hold, but keeping it in focus, then there are certain lines that I'm not going to cross. There's somebody I know that, a devotee, that married a nice, pious person, who they thought this is going to be nice, and, you know, it turns out that that person they married has some who knows what trauma, and because of that trauma then they started to move away from Krishna and even move away from their child, their two children, and even when it came to like going to the park together, he wouldn't. And, you know, then, anyway, so other things. So the less spiritually advanced spouse had also some, you know, purification issues to work out. It wasn't coming through the medium of devotional service. It was, you know, through the medium of acting out those other things. And it put the devotee in, like, dilemma. What to do? I continued serving, but when it came to, like, changing of diet, so they went to a marriage counselor. And the marriage counselor resolved it. He said, you know, when you got married, you made this commitment. You know, that you're vegetarian for life, and now you're going against that. You know, how do you expect your family members to, you know, buy into that one? You know, I wasn't I just heard this story. It's just a detail, but the point is, place Krishna at the center, and certain lines you're not going to cross. And Krishna knows what the circumstance is. That Krishna has put you in the circumstance, and Krishna knows what the circumstance is. So you rely on your connection with Krishna to sustain your spiritual advancement, and in the mood of service, not like, you know, browbeating your spouse that, you know, you're not spiritually advanced, but trying to be, and the spouse can say yes or no, but trying to help your spouse feel supported to take a step. And that's, you know, victory in your service to Krishna for this lifetime. They took a step. Yay! But that doesn't inhibit your spiritual progress because you have your connection with Krishna and with the Sangha devotees to help your spiritual progress. And here's a particular service. It may not be, you know, if I was going to design a spouse relationship, it wouldn't be this one. But it's this one. It's what Krishna's arranged for you, just like this body. I wouldn't have picked this one. But I got this one. So what am I going to do? You know, I wish I could sing better, but I can't sing better. I wish I could, you know, make drawings better, but I can't. You know, I'm practicing. I'm doing my art lessons. But I'm not as good as that one or them. I have the packet that Krishna gave me, so I'm not going to complain. I'm going to use it in service to Krishna according to the ability that Krishna's given. And when one submits one's heart to Krishna like that, the kaleidoscope changes. But Krishna wants us to surrender to Him. And so in the spouse relationship also, it's surrender to Krishna. That's the service. And when you're Krishna conscious, then it moves the configuration of matter. If anything's going to move the configuration of matter, not by pushing against it. That's going to get a pushback. It's by Krishna consciousness, serving in the mood of serving Krishna. And it's true, you know, in other than spouse relationships. Someone else had their hand up. Yes. Yes.
Maharaj, I was reading Krishna book recently, and I read Krishna going to Mathura after Akula Maharaj born in there. When he was walking on the roads of Mathura, like it is written there, Shadalba writes, and all the women who were standing on the top of their houses, they started crying, they were saying symptoms of ecstasy and seeing Krishna. So I was wondering that, is it the case that those women were yogis in previous lives, that they were had received that burden in the form of women, that they were showing those symptoms? Because those symptoms are not being as undescribed, they're being shown by men there. So there's something to that.
I'm not sure what you're asking.
I mean, this question is more in terms of that, like in the text which you read today, that the women who are married, they get the benefit when they're married to a spiritually elevated husband who is by serving him.
This is different. I mean, it's not a one-to-one correlation by any means. Rather, let's say, you know, the brahmanas that saw Krishna entering, they took their puja paraphernalia, set it down in front of Krishna, and started offering puja. Now, they had their, according to their nature, their way of expressing their appreciation and their attraction and worship of Krishna. And there's another set that did it this way, another set that did it that way, and Kubja did it her way, and the weaver did it his way, and the florist did it his way, and the ladies on the rooftops did it their way. So because of the embodiment, it came out in a certain way, because of their psychophysical nature. Now, it may be higher than psychophysical nature. It may be bhava. But, you know, because they had a particular, in their previous life, a particular bhava, they achieved or received female forms, and therefore they're up on the rooftops and they're crying. Maybe. Maybe. Maybe not. But, you know, at least, according to one's embodiment is a statement of one's psychophysical nature, and attraction for Krishna comes out accordingly. Like, in your question, I'm thinking of this very puzzling situation. Very puzzling situation mentioned by our acharyas in relation to the gopis, that some of them were the Rishichari gopis. So there were some men engaged in austerities in the forest during Ram's Leela. When they saw Ram, they became attracted to Ram in conjugal affection. That's not, you know, embodiment. That's bhav. So which situations are psychophysical and which situations are bhava based? I don't know, maybe that's what you're asking, and I the answer is I don't know. Those ladies on the rooftops, were it psychophysical or bhava based? But for sure, one can say when attraction for Krishna becomes awakened, it comes out naturally according to one's nature. And the, you know, like when Krishna entered into the wrestling arena, there are persons that had never seen him before, and they responded differently according to their consciousness. Some saw this, some saw that, some saw the other thing. There's a list of 10 things according to their nature. So now whether that nature is bhava-based or psychophysical-based, who can say? I don't have that qualification to say. But attraction for Krishna comes out according to our nature. And, you know, the washerman. According to nature. Yes?
Is it okay to pray, like, we are in a material situation, circumstance, but it's so disturbing that unless the situation is a little pacified, it's even difficult for me to properly do devotional service because of my contamination of consciousness. So, what should the prayer be?
Help! Not, it's okay, but it's not the best. If you say, Krishna, please change the circumstance. Better is, Krishna, this is a wonderful opportunity that you've given to me. This circumstance is beyond my threshold. I've crossed beyond the threshold of being equipoised and neutral. I'm in great distress. Please give strength so that I can sustain my attachment to you, even in this beyond my threshold circumstance. Please let me always remember let me never forget in this difficult circumstance. So our purpose in life as devotees is to awaken our dormant love and mood of service for Krishna. So when circumstances come to a crescendo like you're describing, like emotional or mental, maxed out circumstance, in one sense, it's good. It's a great opportunity to go beyond, to rely on Krishna beyond our own strength and our own capacity. And lo and behold, when that happens, our capacity increases. Because it's Krishna's help, Krishna's reciprocation. So that would be my recommendation, is look to Krishna. Like, what did the cowherd boys do? Or like, you know, when there was some circumstance beyond their, you know, and very stressful, and it's like that. Krishna, it's like that. Call out more intently, as, you know, we would wish to do regularly, like this question about greed or intense desire for attaining a higher state of Krishna consciousness or Krishna's association. Circumstance forces it. And then it's not exactly greed for a higher thing, it's like survival for the higher thing. I'm drowning in the ocean of difficulty. Krishna. Remembering, you know, it's illusory. It's all temporary. And now you see it, now you don't. So in the moment it looks like you're drowning. But there's, it's all within the mind. The illusory energy, perception of the illusory energy and the happiness and distress of it. Is that something?
Now that you've talked about, you know, don't hang up for not just making it, even transcendental gifts.
Even
transcendental gifts. Rather it comes to mercy.
Yeah. One can hanker for transcendental gifts, but one should know it's not really necessary, because Krishna is kind. It's like, you know, your son's crying, when's breakfast? Your wife's going to provide breakfast. It's okay. It's not like shouldn't. It's okay. But know that even without your asking for such things, they come. So the aspiration can be instead unmixed devotion. When that means just, I want to serve you, that's all. Like Prahlad speaking to Lord Nrisimhadeva. Our relationship is, you're the master and I'm the servant, that's all. There's no mercantile thing going on here. So please don't ask me to take a benediction, because that's a mercantile thing. Even of, you know, the on the spiritual side. No, but at the same time, so please bestow upon me your causeless mercy in the form of unalloyed devotion to you. Please give me, like Prahlad prayed, making this reference because we just observed Nrisimha Chaturdasi. Just please give me Narada association. Because he can train me how to serve you better. That would be very nice. I like that. And the other material and spiritual gifts will come anyways. Anyway, it's when it's relationship of loving service, then all these things are nice. The gopis wanted Krishna as their husband. Not like they shouldn't have asked for that. So it's loving service. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Yeah.